Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to this episode of Talking Points. I'm your host, Brian Kelly, the points guy. And today we've got a really interesting guest. You know, we've had Tony Award winners and CEOs on this podcast, but today I think it's our first James Beard Award winner, 28 times over, I believe. Welcome Danny Meyer, CEO of Union Square Hospitality Group.
I'm so happy to be here and to meet you.
We have come to meet each other because points run deep in your family, from what I hear.
Well, points not only run deep
in travel.
But travel does. So I grew up in St. Louis, and my dad was a travel agent.
Oh,
and
really?
He and my mom, for the first 2 years of their marriage, lived on the border of Alsace and Germany because he was a counterintelligence officer in the army.
Oh,
wow. I promise this story is going somewhere. But the reason that he was recruited to do that was because he had a real gift for languages. Hmm. And the 2 years that they were there were basically spent as a two-year honeymoon because there were no altercations during those 2 years. And they spent their entire time driving through the French countryside, getting to know innkeepers, mostly who would take them in and feed them. So he comes back to St. Louis, starts a travel agency because everyone wanted to know where they should take these driving trips. And he ended up becoming the first American agent for a fledgling group of inns, which were then called Relais de Campagne. They later became Relais and Chateau.
Oh, wow.
And so we would always have French people living in our home. We had a little dog named Ratatouille. We were cooking all the time.
Yeah.
But we also got to travel all the time. Yeah. And he became the president of ASTA, the American Society of Travel Agents.
Oh, wow.
And then later he changed his entire business from designing custom tours, you know, for this person or that person, to designing group tours.
Hmm.
And so
the same, all with a Europe focus, or did he
almost,
ever expand?
Almost all with a European focus. And he decided that he was going to segment part of the airline industry, IATA.
Mm-hmm.
I know you know exactly what that means.
Yeah.
And so anyone who was an airline employee or their family could qualify to take his trips. But anyway, I grew up speaking the language of travel and, you know, learning how to work my way through airports. I traveled first time by myself at the age of 6.
Oh, wow.
And I just connect with people who love travel as a way of life.
And so throughout your business, so you started Shake Shack and a number of other restaurants. Prepping for this podcast, I was blown away just how many. You have, almost 250 Shake Shacks around the world now?
Well, let's get back. Way before there was Shake Shack, there was Union Square Cafe. That was the one restaurant I had for the first 10 years of my career. And then Gramercy Tavern.
Yep. Both of which I can see from my office, which has been and I do all my breakfast meetings or lunch meetings at my Lino. So I am surrounded by your restaurants.
And part of the reason you're certain there's a couple that we did own that you would also be surrounded by, 11 Madison Park and Tabla, Blue Smoke up the street, Marta, our Roman pizza grill. In the early days, travel was really the secret weapon I had. I still think it is, in terms of discovering foods, discovering wines, discovering a new design, a new way of expressing really hospitality. And then the world did catch up because before the internet, you could find ideas 3 or 4 years before anyone else because you had to know how to read a map. You had to know how to speak the language so you could ask the local winemaker who really runs the best trattoria in that little village that's barely even on the Michelin map. Today, you don't have to travel to see that dish. You can see photos of it. You can see what people think of it. You can get the recipe.
But I would almost argue in the TripAdvisor age, there's almost too much information, right? Like, how do you synthesize all of that information? And do you still have your network of close friends that you trust? Or are there certain sites in the culinary world of the real good places to go that you recommend?
Absolutely. You know, you synthesize it in a number of ways. I think that as with any criticism, whether it's a movie critic or a food critic or travel critic, over time, if that critic's voice, you may or may not agree with that person all the time, but if the voice is consistent, you start to get a directory in your own mind as to when did our taste agree and disagree, and you can kind of calibrate it. But the other thing, I'm a really good cross-referencer, and there's three or four sites that I like to use, but then there's friends, and I have so many colleagues and friends in the industry. And usually, if you go to a restaurant that you love, that chef is going to lead you to somewhere local that you may not know about. That sommelier is going to lead you to a winery maybe you've never heard about. So travel historically for me has always been about research and development, but it's also about satisfying my love for learning about people, because I think that when you can find the most local things that people eat, the most local places they go, the most local bakery that supplies the most local coffee shop, then you start to learn about who these people are. And it's such a transporting feeling.
So one of the most unique parts of your restaurants is how you treat your employees and the fact that there's no tipping. All of my European friends always say the tipping culture is out of control. And so you made the decision a long time ago to pay your employees so that they didn't depend on tips. Was that because of your travels to Europe, and where, you know, tipping isn't the culture, especially in places in Asia where it's absolutely offensive to tip? What was your thought process?
I think you bring up a really good point. I think that, so we had opened up a restaurant 12 years ago called Union Square Tokyo. Take this the right way, but that's when I say I lost my expansion virginity, because that was the first time we ever had any restaurant that was not in New York City. That was before Shake Shack grew out of New York City. And the time that I spent in Tokyo was so eye-opening. And as you just said, not only is there no tipping there, but if you do it, you're really offending somebody, because they have a principle called omotenashi, which goes even further than what I define hospitality as. And omotenashi is not only anticipation of the needs of someone else, but furthermore, it's delivering on those needs, because seeing the pleasure you've created makes you feel better. And finally, it's delivering on those needs with zero expectation or welcoming of further compensation. So now I've had that
hospitality
experience.
Hospitality in its like ultimate form.
I think so. Yeah. And I see that experience. Then I come back to the States and I realize, you know what? It's not fair of us to impose our culture on them. It's not fair for us to expect that they would understand our culture when they come here. Same thing when Brits would come to our restaurants.
And then it creates friction between the waiters and, oh, these, I have a European table that I'm not going to, you know, like.
Yes, and what a horrible thing to ask someone to do their job, but to understand that their compensation is based on someone's understanding of our cultural norms.
Right.
And so I really wanted to literally take that off the table. And I want to hire people who don't look at the five tables in their section and try to judge, now who should I be nice to based on who I think is going to give me the biggest tip in 2.5 hours. I want someone to be who they are with everybody all the time.
And I'm sure people said it's not going to be possible to do that. I'm sure you got a lot of pushback when you came up with this concept, right? Why do you think you've been able to prove them wrong and get that caliber?
I think stubbornness is part of it. Now, I believe in this so much also from the standpoint of really trying to professionalize our industry. I really get sad sometimes when I would talk to a terrific server at one of our restaurants, and they'd say, well, thank you for the compliment, but I'm really just doing this while I'm pursuing
something
a
else.
Real career as, you know, fill in the blank. And increasingly, I came to learn that in most professions in the United States, where the primary form of income is tipping, that profession is not seen as a credible professional path by a lot of people. And I think that hospitality is incredibly valid, and I want people to look at it as a career where they can advance. It's a painful thing when you see that a tipped employee can make enough money to never have a different job, but it's a dead end because they cannot afford to take a 25% pay cut and become a manager, which could then lead to becoming assistant or general manager of the restaurant, and then
do you have a lot of your waiters moving up the management ranks? Is that
so? Today, more and more we do.
Yeah,
and so now we are their boss. When you come to the restaurant, you're not tipping.
Yeah,
they're getting paid on merit, and they're getting paid obviously well above minimum wage because they have to be. But the other thing we do, we decided while we wanted to eliminate an incentive to be nice to people, we wanted to retain an incentive to sell.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of our formerly tipped employees also receive a share of that night's revenue, irrespective of what night they work that week. And this is a key thing too, Brian, because in the old days, the way you got a raise as a tipped employee is you stay at the restaurant forever.
Yep.
So you finally get the Friday and Saturday night shifts.
Yep.
But God forbid you have to work Monday lunch.
Yeah.
One
of my first jobs, I was a waiter at Philly Steak and Crab outside of Philadelphia. I loved it. At age 18, I was, but I was filling in the shifts that no one really wanted. And I do remember though walking out with like $150 cash. But then I'd have to work Monday and it would be like $31. And it was like highs and lows. But it was those battle axes who had been there forever that earned the right to get the good shifts.
And I just don't think that's good for anybody. I think the guest doesn't necessarily want to feel like they're getting only rookies on Monday lunch. So now when you work in any of our places, you're a willing rookie.
I'm sure I was.
But the guests, the waiters and waitresses and servers and bartenders at our restaurants can work any day, and they're still going to get a cut of that week's revenue.
Have you noticed other restaurants doing this in the U.S., or do you think what will be the turning point where this happens? Because I think everyone who eats out would love to have this, right, where you're not...
The tipping point on this is that it's going to take more time. A lot have tried. A lot have come to me and said, thank you for... One person rather graphically said, thanks for running through the barbed wire first so the rest of us don't have to. So the tipping point is going to come when restaurants find that charging tips on top of their menu prices is turning off their guests, and they're already paying their team more than enough money.
Interesting.
That'll be a while, though.
Yeah. What's your take today? We had a debate on Instagram about tipping housekeeping, tipping doormen and everything. What is your take on that? Do you tip, and who do you tip when you travel, and where do you draw the line? I guess.
Well, I think your question itself is part of the reason I just want to eliminate it, because people feel so confused. They feel confused in their own country. Never mind when they travel somewhere else. Let's take a real easy example. You're going to a local coffee shop, and there's a tip jar on the counter, and you just paid what felt like a lot of money for a cup of coffee, and now you have a choice of feeling guilty that you didn't leave enough or feeling bad that you didn't really feel like that person gave you $2 worth of service.
Yeah.
And I just, I think I'm really, really comfortable going to someone's restaurant that accepts tips, and I'm going to always be a generous tipper because I understand that's how that team is being compensated. But I don't necessarily feel great when I'm buying a cup of coffee, putting an extra buck or two
on a $2 or $3. Yeah.
I feel bad either way.
Uber was so interesting when they first started tipping. It wasn't even like $1. Uber was like 15, 25, or 35%. I remember being like, what? Like, especially on like a ride to the airport. I'm like, that's a huge... I mean, I'm all for people, making a good living. But yeah, it is kind of, it's everywhere now. And yeah, it would be nice to live in a non-tipping world.
And what tipping has always been, been an attempt for the business owner
to
push off on the customer a cost that is in fact a cost, but we don't want to bear it. We want you to feel like, well, since I only paid for the ride out of my left pocket, the tip's coming out of my right pocket, I guess okay.
One of the most ludicrous ways we're seeing that in hotels is resort fees. And, hotels charging for, attendance and, like, all these things. Like at a resort, some resorts are charging up to $95 a night and this extra fee to pay for the things that should be a part of running a resort and included in
I think people don't really enjoy being nickel and dime.
Yeah. Okay, let's take a quick pause right now and hear from our sponsors.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Getting back to Union Square, Tokyo, like, what did you learn? So that was your first expansion, and that's a pretty tough market to enter. What did you learn there?
Well, the good news is we have a partner, fantastic partner. In fact, even with Shake Shack, which is now in 14 different countries, we always have a local partner because we know what we don't know. We don't know nearly as much about real estate or sourcing and distributing product. And I think what we learned in Tokyo is fascinating. The group that we work with, which is a company called Wonder Table, already has a great reputation in the restaurant industry, the real estate industry. What they really wanted more than anything was not just Union Square Cafe. What they wanted was to learn more about hospitality. Because even though the Japanese have the expression we mentioned, omotenashi, as he told me when we first got together, our partner, he said, in general, I think we in our culture are much better at regimentation and following directions in order than you guys are. If you give us a recipe, we can cook it perfectly. Yeah. Give us a sheet of music, we can play it perfectly. He said, but if you've ever wondered why the Japanese are so fascinated by American jazz, it's that jazz is improvisation, and that's what hospitality is. Hospitality is the opposite of regimentation. If you, and he took me through one of these 8-story malls that you see a lot of, and he said, I want you to look at that person. So I looked at the person. The person bowed. And he said, that person doesn't know whether or not you wanted to be bowed to. They just do it because that's their job.
Yeah.
But he said, I want you to teach us how to treat each person as an individual. Because I read your book, Setting the Table, when you used to talk about hospitality is a dialogue. Service is a monologue. Hospitality is where one size fits one. Service is where one size fits all. And so we have learned a lot from each other.
It hard training those employees in Japan to get that? Like, because you're kind of trying to unwire them to think differently.
Yeah, well, it was one of the most gratifying experiences ever. The only hard thing, and I'm sure you've had this experience, is every time you say something, you have to wait another minute till it gets translated. And then you say, you have to remember where you were. But on more than one occasion, and I've also seen this in the Middle East with employees at Shake Shack. I've seen this in Dubai and Kuwait. I've seen this in Turkey and Russia with Shake Shack employees. Many of the hourly employees are either from Poland or the Philippines in those countries. And same thing I saw in Japan. People cry because for their entire lives, they've been told not to be themselves in a service interaction, a transaction.
It's and crying from like a liberation standpoint.
Yes, yes. And what the hospitality transaction is, it's giving you permission. In fact, it's a mandate to try to, in addition to the technical thing you're doing, I am technically trained to put this food down or pour that bottle of wine or clear that plate in a specific way. But with hospitality, which is very different from service, because it's an emotional transaction, you are asking people to try to understand who is this person, what does this person need, and then call on yourself to ask yourself, if I were that person, what would I want? And the cool thing that we would teach, interestingly, the Japanese team that we first trained in Tokyo had never heard of the golden rule, do unto others as you would have others do unto you. So this was a little tough to teach because that is the golden rule, but that's not the golden rule of hospitality. The golden rule of hospitality is do unto others as you believe they want done unto them.
Right.
Because we're all different.
Right.
And that's where the crying starts, because there was this liberation from being told, don't be yourself, do the thing you're supposed to do.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
And they could still make people even, I think it took some trust to realize that they can make people even happier when they customized the delivery of the service.
So much of your business model is on the human element in hospitality. As more and more now, whether it's mobile ordering, you know, you go into a McDonald's and it's all touch screens and it's, you know, I get my Shake Shack most of the time through Postmates, especially when I have a little bit of a hangover. There's just nothing like it.
What's your go-to order, just so I know?
Lately I do the Shack Stack, the burger and the...
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah. And then cheese fries. Okay. But what is your take on mobile ordering and taking that human element out of it? Obviously, it's better. I hate waiting in lines. I do like being with people, but do you see that as a risk to your business that you built this brand so much on that human interaction?
You know, it reminds me of back in 1998, we were starting to play around with online reservation systems, and we finally picked one called OpenTable, which I initially was against because I said, but that means that all these incredibly nice people who answer our phones, we're going to give up that amazing hospitality moment.
Yeah.
And one of my business partners, who's still with me, said, well, Mr. Hospitality, last time I checked, you said hospitality is being on the other person's side, and someone who's making their reservation online is probably doing it because that's how they want to make their reservation. Yeah. They don't really want to have to worry about your business hours in whichever time zone you're in. And I would say the same thing is absolutely true of how people want their food today, which is if you don't want to wait in line, and there is technology to allow you not to have to wait in line, who the heck am I to stop that?
Time
and
is money.
What is our responsibility is to find a way to make that experience feel even more like we're on your side than not. And we're just scratching the surface. I mean, I really want to be at the point where, you know, the person who would have hopefully recognized you and said, welcome back, would you like the usual order? Mm-hmm. I would like to be at the point where the machine can do that more
that
consistently.
Knows that I'm hungover. My phone can sense my blood alcohol levels. Brian, you're going to need your... No.
Well, the first time my son Peyton came to the Astor Place Shake Shack, which is where we first tested kiosks, and Peyton said, well, the cool thing is the machine's not going to probably ever wake up on the wrong side of the bed. We'll probably always get...
software update, yeah.
Probably always get your order right.
Yeah.
And then to the degree that you have human beings in the place, they don't have to multitask. They can do 100% of the hospitality, and they won't have to worry about hospitality while they're also trying to do a transaction that can be a hard thing. So when we can get the machines to virtually smile at you by remembering you, and you know, we know what your last order was, and we know how to say welcome back. We know how to say, hey, Brian, was it a hangover last time, or are you just on a diet today?
Yeah. Food on planes is a touchy subject with frequent travelers. I remember being on a Dash 8 regional jet from LaGuardia to Ithaca. It was a 90-degree day. We're sitting on the tarmac. There's no air. And someone next to me opens up a tuna wrap. And The gag that I was just like, are you kidding me? I
mean, you have a thing for tuna in general?
I actually like tuna, but
it was like Parmesan
was on it, and I was like, this is not
for me. When someone on an airplane unwraps something with garlic
and
whatever it smelled like on the ground, it smells 50 times that
times,
much.
Right? So that's why I'm like, I'm very careful. I'll bring a bagel, but not an everything bagel. So what will you bring on the plane, and what will you not bring on an airplane?
I'd say the only thing I ever bring on a plane is Shake Shack because I want people to see it because I'm shameless.
You're shameless.
Shameless
promoter.
Promoter.
That makes two of us.
I think the breakfast sandwiches at Shake Shack are a fine way to start the day.
Yeah.
But outside of that, I'm not a big bringer food. Back in the old days when you could bring wine on the plane, I would often bring a half bottle of wine with me and open it very carefully.
Yeah. But so, Shake, someone told me recently that a lot of restaurants have created breakfast menus because airports, in order to be in an airport, you have to serve breakfast or something like that. Was that the genesis behind Shake Shack's breakfast? Like, were you
absolutely. Yeah, we otherwise never would have served breakfast. Just like when we opened Maialino in the Gramercy Park Hotel, the deal was you guys have to serve breakfast. Yeah. We had never served breakfast in a restaurant. And the funny thing is that if you go to breakfast at Maialino, you'll notice that there's not more than 5% of the guests who are travelers staying in the hotel. It's almost all New Yorkers who have made this their downtown club.
How do you envision growth for the brand?
So that's another great question. I want to share that in my industry, historically, the food business would not grow internationally until it had first oversaturated in the United States. That was just the recipe for how this all worked. We did a deal with a company, a fantastic company based in Kuwait called Al Shaya, for 20 Middle Eastern restaurants when we only had 3.5 Shake Shacks.
That's crazy.
And I thought it was crazy too. I mean, I had never been there before, and I sent a couple of my business partners. They flew Emirates over. They had a great time. They came back and they said, Danny, this this company is the Starbucks licensee in the Middle East. Every Starbucks we went to in the Middle East is packed and cleaner and better run than any of the three that you can walk to from your office on Union Square. And I said, if we could learn how to grow from an expert copy machine far away from New York, far away from our regular guest, learn about distribution, learn about training, learn about design, because we wanted to keep Shake Shack as small as we could for as long as we could. This gave us a way to grow without anyone knowing that we were growing.
And learn from
And we learned so much from it. And so that particular company did such a great job with us in the first four Middle East countries that we worked in. And the other countries that we're now in all have different international partners.
How do they, do you change the menu in all these? Like, will they say you got to do this in Russia or that, you know, add an item or something, or do you keep it?
We actually try to do that. Yeah. In fact, if you go to any Shake Shack in the United States, we call it the 80-20 rule. 80% of the menu is something you would see everywhere, but 20% should be somewhat localized.
What's your favorite random thing from a Shake Shack menu somewhere? Is it?
Probably Austin, Texas, where we do the Lockhart Link burger. So we get a wonderful smoked sausage from Kreitz Market in Lockhart, Texas. And
I've never been hungrier in a podcast recording.
We slice
right
it
now.
And put it right on top of a Shack burger, and it is good.
That sounds amazing. So your company's expanding like crazy. Where do you love to travel? Like, what's your destination that you take your family when it's like, this is time to get away?
The truth of the matter is I'm always torn between a place I've never been and a place I love. So if it's a place I've been, the ones that we probably return to most frequently would be Rome, London, and Paris. Domestically, I'm always happy in California.
Yeah.
I'm happy traveling anywhere because for me, it's truly the only time I'm ever by myself.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, I wrote my book in secret, traveling from New York to San Francisco and back when I was on the board of Open Table, and there was no Wi-Fi on planes back then.
So did you like it better in the days where we didn't have Wi-Fi on planes? I go both ways with that.
I'd like it better now because I would hate to be without it now that I've had it.
Yeah.
But I do miss the time when it was you and your book and your magazines or whatever it was you were writing. I've never been a big movie guy on planes.
I never watch movies on planes. I'll put Bose headphones on with the sound noise canceling on, and I'll like sit there and read or like do research or something. Yeah.
You haven't asked me this question, but I just have to share because how do you talk to the points guy and not at least talk about points for a second?
Well, are you a points guy?
So I am a points guy, and I'm a points guy from way back. I have my frequent flyer number memorized from TWA. No, many digits from many years ago. I think that it's a brilliant concept, and when done well, it is golden handcuffs unlike anything else.
Yeah.
And
I call it the elite status hamster wheel. Like once you're on it, it's like you can't get off.
Right.
Like
I've been diamond on Delta now because why wouldn't you fly Delta when you're serving food and in first class? And also we've got some food in their terminals as well. But it got to the point where I would be at a board meeting in Texas or on the West Coast, and one of the other board members would have a private jet and say, I'm going to give you a lift home. And I'd say to myself, you got to find a reason to say no thank you because you can't give up the miles. And I'm going, now, wait a second. This is a little insane because I'm earning the miles so I can have a first-class upgrade. I'm getting a guy who's going to save me going through security at the airport, saving me an hour and a half of my life.
Yep. But it's all about the miles.
Ah, help me understand me.
It's a drug, man. But how is it? So designing food for airplanes, I mean, and putting your name on something that's going to be cooked by someone else in a tiny, you know, heated up in a galley. Like, what has that experience been like, working with Delta on those Delta ones?
Well, working with Delta has been great because they care about it. And they understand that you know, once you get someone to their destination on time, the real differentiator are two things. What was the in-flight experience like in terms of what you consumed, whether it was entertainment or food, and were the people nice to you? Delta, amongst others, I think the industry's getting the message finally. Delta really gets the message. I think the experience of doing it is way harder than we ever imagined.
Yeah.
We knew that the bar was very low. People kind of put airline food a half a click behind hospital food in general.
So
And, you know, there's reasons for that.
Yeah.
The galleys used to have a lot more space.
And they've gotten really small.
One of the things that blows my mind is why in a day and age when every really, really nice hotel room has its own little coffee machine, that you can't get a good cappuccino or espresso on an airplane.
That's so true.
And I think that's changing, but it's all about inches in the galley. And what we've learned is that the less hands on our food, the better. So we're trying to produce more and more of the food at Union Square Events, which is our big catering kitchen here in New York City, which is why the only food you'll ever see our name on is food that emanated from New York.
Oh, really? From that?
You would never get it on a transcon flight from L.A. here. And I think what we're learning is that simpler is better. People are not going on an airplane.
But yet no one does a good burger in the sky, really. Or do you guys, you haven't done...
We've done a couple specials with Delta, but you're right about that. And it all has to do with how the food is reheated.
Yeah.
Think about pasta. Think about how much we all love pasta. Yeah. But the only pasta you ever really, really liked on an airplane was probably lasagna.
Mm.
Something that you could put in an oven and not worry that it was going to dry out.
Yeah.
You'll never see spaghetti on an airplane because it's going to either get crispy or it's going to be complete mush.
Yeah.
And it's a hard thing. I think soups can do really, really well. Delta
does really good soups, I have to say. And who doesn't love a good soup?
Yeah. And the other thing with soup is that it can convey a lot of flavor. Your taste buds are actually muted when you're in the sky.
That's why everything's so salty, right?
That's why a lot of things are salty. You'd be surprised at the things that the airlines think about, though, with respect to food. For example, for some obvious reasons, bean soup is out. They don't want people having any...
Wait, why is that?
Yeah, they don't want people having stomach issues while they're in the airplane. No cabbage.
Huh.
I'm telling you,
always serve asparagus, too, on planes, which...
That doesn't tend to interfere with your seatmate.
That's true. So if you're going to fly on a Delta flight out of JFK and you can be served your food, do you bring your shake... Well, obviously you said you already bring the Shake Shack on, but will you also eat...
Yes.
Yeah, I
do that, and I walk. I'm the weirdo walking up and down the aisle to see if other people are enjoying what they're eating as well. I almost always introduce myself to the purser or the flight attendant. I've actually once had three different meals on a flight that had three dinner choices. I got all three of them because I really want to road test these things. Now, the first time we ever served food on Delta, it was strictly the JFK Heathrow flight. This was several years ago. Someone on our team came up with the really fun idea of having your cocktail made seat side. And I was one of the first flights. Delta sent me over there to experience the whole thing. I had three different entrees, had to do the cocktail. The entire shaker burst open all over my lap. And I said, you actually could not have picked a better person to do this to.
Aisle or window seat? What's your preference?
Aisle.
Why is that? Don't you like looking out? Everyone's aisle seats these days. I'm like totally team window.
I don't like to be.
I'm sure your son Peyton likes the window seat, right?
Fine either way.
Either way? Okay. He just likes being on a plane.
Yeah, no, I don't like to be landlocked. I've got long legs and I like to get up when I want to get up and I don't want to have to ask somebody else to please move.
Yeah.
I don't like that.
Good point. All right, Danny Meyer, it's been fascinating talking about your business, travel. It's at the core of who you are as a person. I think I need to fly to Delta and get me some Shake Shack, like right now. Christy, when's my next flight? Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Brian.
Safe travels.
And thanks for what you do to help the world travel better.
I think everyone just needs to travel a little bit more and this world would be a better place. That's it for this episode of Talking Points. Huge thanks to our fascinating guest, Danny Meyer, and a big thank you to the best podcast team in the biz, Caroline Chagrin, Margaret Kelly, and my amazing assistant, Christy Matsui. And also a huge welcome to TPG Offices, Peyton Meyer, who is a points nut, and it was good to meet you. That's it for this episode. Safe travels, everyone.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.